Right. So just a few minutes back, I found out from Guru that there is some other work also that we do, which probably has more overlap with the students' work here. So I'll try to go through this first topic that I originally had planned for today as quickly as I can, maybe in half an hour, and then I'll talk about that other piece of work. So this first work that I'll talk to you about today is something that we call non-blocking rights. And this is in collaboration with some of my students, and I'll tell you about the students towards the end of the talk, a little bit more about what they actually did. To introduce the problem that we are trying to solve here, the first point that I'll make is that memory access granularity is typically much smaller than the granularity at which you access storage. So memory can be accessed even at the granularity of a word, which is 4 bytes or 8 bytes. Typically, if you access memory through the file system interface, you give a set of bytes, or you read a set of bytes through the operating system, and that could be smaller than the granularity at which you access the disk drive as well. Disk drives are typically managed at the granularity of pages, which are 4 kilobytes large, right? So there is this basic discrepancy in the granularity at which you access memory versus storage. So that's the first point I'd like to mention. So what that means is that when you write to a page that is not in physical memory or DRAM, then that page must first be fetched into memory and then it is updated. So I'll walk you through the process that the operating system goes through. When a process tries to write to a page that's not in physical memory, it's not there yet, that error, or rather exception, is handled by the operating system today. And the way the operating system handles this exception is that it would go ahead and issue a page fetch operation from the backing store. Once that fetch is completed and the page is populated in DRAM, the operating system returns control back to the process. So this is, think about the case where there is a virtual memory page fault. So the operating system takes control, reads in the page. Once the page is in memory, allows the process to redo the same instruction. And in this instance, the write will be successful because the page is in memory. Right? So this is what we have today. Now the story is just a little bit different if the process were to write to the page through the operating system, let's say a write system call, right, to the file system. Then the only difference there is that the operating system handles the write itself. So there is no return of control and having the process do the write again. The operating system does everything, and finally after it finishes the task, reads in the page, updates the page, would return back control to the OS. But in general, at a high level, what's happening is that when the process is writing to a page that's not in memory, that page is synchronously fetched from the storage, updated, and then the process can go forward. So this has been the state of the art for the past few decades. Okay, so we looked at when such designs got adopted, and they got adopted in virtual memory systems and file systems way back in the 60s. So that's something for us to keep in mind. Now we were doing a completely different project, unrelated to this project, and we saw what was happening is that there were a lot of these writes, accesses to memory, to pages that were not in physical memory, and the system would go through this process. So we asked the question, why wait for data? That is, why wait for the page to be fetched when the application doesn't really need the data? If you think about it, the application already has the data that it tries to write. But the application needs to wait for the entire page to be fetched so that the subparts of the page can be updated. So this was the question we started with. And the reason this question, or asking this question, is important is because that I/O operation incurs a significant latency during which the process cannot make any progress. So that's the question we asked, and we went back and thought about this a little bit more and realized that this design has been around for a long time and even existing today. Right? So we saw this behavior in Linux. We saw it in FreeBSD, We saw it in the Zen virtual machine monitor. We saw in the VMware ESX hypervisor, because we have source access to VMware, that's why I can tell you that. It's there everywhere. And later on, I'll also show you that this basic design is applied to systems beyond a conventional operating system, right? Like beyond a virtual machine monitor, there are other things or other kinds of use cases where a similar behavior is observed. So the complementary observation is that we are moving to a world where these out-of-core page fetch rates are going to increase. There will be more and more page fetching in systems. And some of the reasons behind that observation is that memory today tends to be significantly more overcommitted because of virtualization. So we saw a study out of VMware, this is one of those, where a bunch of system administrators who use ESX were asked the question, do you use memory overcommitment in your system? And 57% of the people said, yes, we overcommit memory in our system. And that was in 2008. And today, through 2012, that number we expect will be significantly higher. What is not shown here is another study from VMware, which states that the in terms of utilization, so you can look at memory overcommitment either as a black box, yes or no question to sysadmins, or you can also look at memory utilization in systems. And it turns out that of all the resources, CPU, memory, and network and storage, memory is the most utilized. So memory, the sysadmins drive memory to more than 35% utilization on an average. Okay, so this, I can tell you the source later on, it's not shown here, but it's a VMware report, a recent report, whereas CPU is typically utilized at 10% or below. So there is that discrepancy also, that admins feel the need to push memory utilization higher and higher. What that would mean for page fetch rate is that it's going to keep increasing, right? Because the amount of memory and the cost of memory is not significantly getting any better. So this drives up at the same point that there are more processes with multi-core and in virtualized environments. The other observation is that the memory hierarchy is now changing. As you know, we now have SSDs, right? Flash-based solid-state storage. So admins are even more encouraged to push towards memory overcommitment because they know that I now have a really fast tier of storage that can be accessed when data is not in memory. Again, higher page fetch rate. Now, what this means for yes? It's overcommitted means that the system itself has a certain amount of memory, and it's committing more than that amount of memory to the virtual machine. And later on, I'll tell you what is the mechanism inside the hypervisor called hypervisor demand paging, and I'll tell you how that works. So these are some of the observations that we draw upon.
So the fact that you have faster tracking store reduces the latency of your
fetch. True, true, certainly.
It seems like this
if they have, they have SSDs and they can start really quickly, the latencies go up. Sorry, the latencies go down. But the fact is that the process still needs to wait for a certain finite amount of time.
So there's two things here. One is the actual latency of accessing that store.
There is a subtle point here, which is that when your page fetch rates go up, right, you have parallelism of access, especially when you have virtual machines, multiple virtual machines. So although the individual I/O operation latency is small, there is a huge queue inside the hypervisor of I/Os waiting to happen. Now, if you have a write, such as what I showed you earlier, that latency includes the waiting time inside the hypervisor.
Latency is not accessed the same way as this stuff, right? They're not accessing the queue. They don't have to be.
There is a queue buildup because the amount of outstanding requests inside the SSD is also fixed, It would typically be 32 or something.
But it's better. There's more parallelism than on a disk.
There is much more parallelism than disk access, for sure. So because of that, people are driving more I/O to the SSD. More I/O means more queue buildup inside the hypervisor or inside the guest. So in terms of latency, all of that queue needs to be accounted for. It's not just the device latency. Yes.
So
in
the case that
request
that are in the queue, the request that end up with are they better off using a normal disk rather than SSD? Your request are better to use the queue and wait for getting to SSD.
Very good point. So there are, I'll point you to one paper from Narasimha Reddy, which was published, I believe, in MassCorp 2010, where they actually investigated this precise question that you raised. I think they built something called a hybrid storage device, which has an SSD and disk drive as well. And they realized that, you know, rather than pushing more and more I/Os to the SSD, beyond a certain point, it makes sense to send your I/O to a much higher latency disk because there is a queue latency also. Right? So you want to equalize end-to-end latency rather than per request device level latency. Very good.
Just
taking one step back, is there any study or any profiling of why an application program, the write will be so often it's a database that are not right. Is there some programming technique or is there some reason or some particular type of program where this happens more often? It happens, for instance, when you have a file system, it's much more easy to visualize why it might happen, right? You have pages, you have your file on disk, you want to update it. Right? So what the operating system does is that fetches that portion of the file.
I understand that it can
for the file system, yes.
I'm asking, is there something that can be thought by different programming languages, where we ensure that it is in memory before we do write.
So there is one aspect or one alternate solution that I'll talk about very briefly now, which is prefetching of data. So
right.
Data that is you anticipate
to be
right. The operating system now does it seamless to the application. It observes sequential access patterns and it engages prefetching by itself. Now the application could deliver hints to the OS and say, okay, I would need these pages in the near future because I'm going to use them. That's certainly possible with an alternate programming model, and if such programming models exist, what we are doing here will not be as useful. Absolutely true. But those sorts of programming models, I'm sure they existed in the past, but over time they have not sustained because of the complexity involved.
So the effectiveness of the OS prefetch you're saying is not good. You've done all your measurements.
Yeah, I'll tell you in a bit what happens. So let me give you some data first to motivate why this problem is important. We looked at three classes of workloads. Image processing workloads, which does some rendering of images, or developer class of workloads, which where a programmer or developer does what they usually do, and in this case it's unit and performance testing, and then server class application database and mail. And what we measured was, to do this measurement, we looked at full system memory access traces. So we instrumented this virtual machine monitor called QMU to report all memory access traces. So these are not disk access, these are memory access traces. And then we said, okay, if memory was this big, and if we use a global LRU page replacement algorithm, what are the fraction of writes which would need to access disk? Right? So those are what I report as percentage of non-blocking calls or faults that we can address if we were able to do or solve the problem earlier that I mentioned. Right? So this is the potential savings. The percentage of writes that, or actually percentage of all faults, including reads and writes, that could be handled better if the problem earlier were solved. And you see that the number varies across all of these classes of workloads. Interestingly, for some server workloads, there is a substantial savings that you could possibly get. It turns out that as much as 80% of the out-of-core writes could actually benefit if you were to solve that problem. Right? Interestingly, in the solution that I'll show you briefly, up to 90% of reads to out-of-score pages can also benefit. And I'll show you in a bit why that happens. So the basic approach that we use in our system is the following. As before, the process performs the write to a page that's not in the DRAM. And as before, the operating system intervenes. The operating system stores that update in memory in a patch, rather buffers the update to the page. So it doesn't update the page itself, but just stores the update. Then it issues the IO request to storage. So it's the issue operation. As soon as the IO is issued, it returns back to the process. Now the process is free to make progress. At some later point, that page is fetched into memory and that patch is merged into the page. So that happens in the background. The process is not aware. As from the perspective of the process, nothing really changed functionally. Right? It wrote to memory, it still writes to memory. It's just that the page it wrote to was not immediately updated, but the update is there in memory. At some later point, the page is fetched into memory and updated, right, in the back. So what are the benefits of doing this? Right? First of all, because the process does not wait, and this is just one, right? I mean, there could be many such write calls in parallel throughout the execution of the application. So that leads to improvement in execution time. And the other point here is that since many writes can now be issued, or many page fetches can now be issued by the same application. So imagine the same application process, it moved forward, did another write to another page. That original IO is going on, next IO is issued. So there is more IO parallelism. And as Umesh pointed out earlier, with SSDs, more IO parallelism is actually better. Because there are a lot of parallel channels inside the SSD that can be retrieved.
But what about the semantics? What was published by the
world
before and now?
Right.
Cache coherence, parallel access, multiple access. Very good point. And things like that.
Right. Very good point.
Yeah.
The key point, I mean, I'll go into a lot more detail on the correctness aspects of the system, but the high level point that I'd like to bring up here is that any process that tries to access the data which this process wrote always gets to read from the patch. So it gets the most up to date. If the process overwrote its own patch, that previous patch is replaced.
The patch is just like a tertiary cache. Now we have
a cache level. It's a cache level that
it's
an inclusive cache in some sense. The in-memory inclusive cache for memory base.
What if the patch doesn't have that page? So that's another thing, right? Patch has some finite size.
Right. So the patch sometimes can span multiple pages. So when it does, we create multiple patches.
What if you run out of patch pages?
In memory, right?
Patch space. You run out of patch space.
So if you would run out of patch space if you run out of memory, right? So that patch is just a portion of a page which would have resided in memory otherwise. That page is not in memory, just a patch exists. When the page comes in, that patch is merged and the patch is freed. It's no longer recorded.
This is in kernel.
It's all in the OS. All inside the OS.
This is the thing. What is the size of if for every byte of 1 byte or 2 byte? What will be your patch size?
Right. So the right now we are maintaining the patch as a queue of patches. It's a patch queue. So every write creates a patch, except if the write is an overwrite. There is metadata, yes. So we are maintaining all of that inside the operating system. At some point, so one of the optimizations we did in our system is that we maintain patches on a per page granularity. If the amount of patches or memory consumed by patches plus the metadata goes beyond a certain point, we actually block the process. We don't allow it to create any more patches. We fetch the page, update the page, and then allow the process. Right, exactly. So there are some optimizations that we built into our system.
So multiple writes to the same page will create patches?
Overwrites will overwrite the patch.
Will
create multiple, it's a patch queue per page, a queue of patches per page.
It's a write that offset, say 10, and then after a later point, before the merge happens, the write that offset 30.
Right.
So you only two patches.
There will be two patches.
So for the read, then what happens? So somebody is reading from that page.
If someone reads from the page,
which batch will
within a batch,
the
right, so the read comes as an offset. Each batch has the metadata which tells me what the offset of the batch is.
Correct.
So if the read can be so serviced,
a batch which has a particular offset came,
right,
and then return that.
Yes.
Now there's
increased
read latency, but
it's
not
the same. The read latency is increased.
We're doing some work.
There is some work.
Out which and then.
Right, so there are some comparisons that we have to make on the CPU. Yes.
And how
does
it work for delivery systems? If you have content accessibility in Word, like in the worst case, on two separate CPUs, and your patch is there, not on that cache line, it's there somewhere else. So, what is the synchronization?
Well, today's systems provide you cache coherence in the hardware. So when you access memory, it's cached on a local core. Let's say if some other core accesses the same piece of memory, if the local cache line is updated, it's coherent by hardware.
Read and write content. In a normal case, you have a page for the write code, which happened earlier. You have content read, the cache coherency. And then we'll take care of that. But in this case, since the write goes to the patch file.
Right? It's not a file.
The patch page.
It's in memory.
It's in memory. If it goes to the patch page, let's say, which is not the page which you actually go to, then there would be a how is this?
See, there is only one destination. Regardless of which core you're accessing this patch from. Like one memory address that all the cores will read from. Or write, right? And if there are two cores that are simultaneously, let's say, reading and writing, if they do not synchronize themselves via some other mechanisms like locks, the operating system does not provide any ordering guarantees anyway. So the same no guarantee, is provided in our system. There are no guarantees. If you want ordering, you use locks. Like our condition variables or whatever the mechanism you would like.
Well, the base is also interesting to be related to L1 or L2 capture on the core. Right? So now you have a copy of the base in the core. Then there will be, but you don't have, it's not like a layered cache for all the cores.
So for that what we do is that as soon as the page is loaded into memory, we apply all the patches first, before unlocking the page and making it available to the application.
At that point, you remove from the patch page.
Yeah, patch is gone because we already merged it into the original page. And now the page itself becomes accessible.
And then it connects to your regular code.
Yes.
So the application has an additional latency of merging for the read operation.
Yes, correct. Not merging, but scanning through the patches.
I mean, yeah, you scan and then patch into the whatever page is there.
For writes. You're talking about writes or reads?
No, for reads.
Okay.
Let's say I have updated a page and that is created as a patch for your operation. So our connection sometimes we're reading the page. That page is not there in the So when that page is placed to memory, it has to be merged with the objects that has happened in the system, right?
There is no merging because it's just a read operation. Right? So we scan through the patch queue and find out if that location was written to and contained within a patch. And if it is, we return the data from the patch to the application.
But if I am using the complete block,
the whole page?
Yeah, the whole page. Okay. Then I have to merge the data, whatever the...
Yes. Absolutely. Right. So the part that I didn't tell you here is that if there is a portion of the page that doesn't exist within the patch or has not been updated recently, the process is blocked. The page is fetched. The page, maybe already the I/O is going on. The process is blocked until the page is fetched, and the first thing that's done is that the patches are merged. And then the process is allowed to read. So whatever it reads is the most up-to-date version of the page.
So for the same offset, if you have like a write-read-write sequence, you make it two batches for the same offset, two write.
So for that specific question, if there is a write-read-write pattern, the write will create a patch.
Right.
If the read will read from a patch, the next write will override the previous patch.
So how will the read from the patch? it's reading from the cache range is there.
The process is accessing a region of memory that's not in physical memory. So the operating system gets intervened, right? Our operating system intervenes and we go through this mechanism of first fetching the page, applying the patches, and then having the application. As soon as a page is fetched into memory, the first thing we see is that are there any outstanding patches on the page? If there are, we merge that those patches in immediately before making the page accessible. Can we have zombie patches? Yeah. Great question. That's one of the questions that we struggled with, right? So, what could happen in this system that will not happen? Because if you notice, what we are doing is we create the patch and issue the IO operation immediately. So, which means that at some later point, the page will come into memory, we merge the patch in, and free the patch. So, there will not be any zombie patches in this specific version of our solution. But we have two other variants. And that problem arises in both of those variants. And I'll tell you about those variant solutions. Okay, so the first advantage of this is that page fetch becomes asynchronous, which means that the process doesn't need to block. So here, I've already told you about this, but let me show it to you graphically that a process, when it does a blocking write, this is a conventional system, writes to a page P. It has to wait, you know, all that solid box is waiting time. Process cannot make any progress. After that, it performs some thinking, does some calculations, and then does a read on the page P. Now, in the conventional system, the read does not have any latency because the page is already fetched, right? And does some other computation. Okay. So now the alternate mechanism, the non-blocking write, write performed to the page P. Since this is a non-blocking write, the process is not waited up. It immediately goes into the next thinking state. Does its computation, right? In the meanwhile, by the way, the IO has already been issued for the page. So the disk is doing its work. When the process performs a read, it must block. And here we are assuming that the process is reading from an offset that is not contained in the patch, right? So it must block. It waits for a certain amount of time, which in this case turns out to be a shorter time because the IO was already in progress. So we save some time. And then after the read completes, we merge the patch in whatever was outstanding and then allow the application to continue for the next thinking. So this is the difference. So you see that there are savings in time because of the asynchrony in the page fetch operation. The other advantage is page fetch parallelism. So as before, in this is a slightly different example. The process writes to page P, writes to page Q, right, and then reads from page P. Now in this case, the read does not have to block because the page is already in memory, right? In a non-blocking write, what's going to happen is that the process writes to page P. The IO starts in the background. In parallel, the process writes to page Q. IO starts in the background again. The original process performs a read to page P. That needs to block because the page is not in memory, assuming the offset is not contained in the patch again. But you see again, the overall time that the application requires is much lesser than what it would otherwise have. Right? So these are the two advantages, this page fetch parallelism and asynchronous. Now what are the alternatives, and Shiv Kumar brought up some of these earlier, right? So there is perfect DRAM provisioning is one possibility. Can we provision our system perfectly so that we don't have to incur any page fetch? Is that even possible? And if it is, then what we are talking about here is, you know, not really useful. And so the problem with this thinking is that working sets are inherently unpredictable and also unbounded. Right. In terms of physical memory size, the application can go through many phases of memory use, and overall the footprint can be larger than the amount of physical memory you have. And if you were to provision your memory to store all your working sets, then you may end up spending a lot of money to buy data, right? So that's one of the issues with perfect data provisioning, and no one does that. Now, the first time the page is accessed, and this is a compulsory method, you still have the page access latency because initially your pages are all on disk. They're not loaded into memory API, unless you would have your application hint the OS to load. But then when, if the application does that, you still have to wait for all the pages to load before you can start the application. Right? So page fetch latency upon first access, even if you were to perfectly provision DRAM, still a problem. Right? With our solution, non-blocking writes, for all the writes, that latency is eliminated. Right, so the second approach is prefetching, right, where the operating system somehow figures out that there is a sequential access pattern or some access pattern going on and fetches the page before it is accessed. Now, prefetching systems today exist, widely used, right, but they do incur from false negatives and false positives, right. So there are limitations, and most of the prefetching implementations today work for sequential access patterns. When you have random memory access, that's really not possible because the application needs to provide the hint, otherwise the OS cannot really do anything. Now there are other classes of solutions. There are implementations for asynchronous system calls, right? So when you perform a write operation, you can tell the operating system that will perform this write asynchronously. Now today's operating systems do perform asynchronous writes, but only for pages that are already in memory. So these are writes from memory to disk. We are talking about a complementary problem altogether. We are talking about writes to pages that are not in memory. These work for pages that are already in memory, and the asynchronously written to disk. Right? That's what we have to do. So what we provide is an entirely complementary mechanism, and oftentimes these asynchronous system calls also, although they are complementary, the way the solution is implemented, they are a little more heavyweight than the solution that we are proposing, is because they use additional threads to wait on the I/O. The way our system is built, we do not use any additional threads at all. Right? So it's extremely lightweight compared to the other solutions. There are a couple of other solutions that you might be wondering about whether it's related or not. And it turns out that they are also complementary. There is this work called Xsync FS, which was published in OSBI a few years ago. Again, it's about asynchronously writing pages that are already in physical memory to disk. And then there is another piece of work that was published in SOSPI, I believe, a few years back called Featherstitch. And that optimizes the writing of pages that are interdependent, that have ordering requirements, and increasing the parallelism within the OS when you're doing dependent I/O. So again, that's complementary as well. Because the reason I put these in is people tend to ask me these questions, right? You know, how is it related to this system and how is it related? Turns out that all of these are entirely complementary. Now the challenges, let me tell you some of the challenges. It's not easy to achieve what I talked to you earlier about. There are two types of writes that can occur in the system. The first one is a conventional operating system call, right? It's a write system call, and that comes with the arguments, and I'm sure all of you have written programs that you write, where you pass a buffer to the operating system, the piece of memory, the number of bytes to write, and the address to write it, right? Of a device, right? Some offset within a device. And then the other way of writing to memory is through a store instruction. And the store, when I say store instruction, I actually mean any machine instruction that can perform a write. It could also be multi-word move operation, or moving a chunk of memory from one location to another location. So x86 actually supports a lot of complex modes for writes to memory. Right? But basically what you have here is a floating address. So the challenge now is just using the floating address, how do we create a patch? It's not possible. So we need more information. For instance, we need how much data got written. And we need to know what data got written so that we can create the patch for it. In the end, what we do need is a patch where we have a new buffer, the number of bytes, and the destination address. That's what we need. The first route is actually very straightforward, and that's what I call the super write, right? Because the operating system takes the write and creates the patch. The application requests the operating system directly, right? The super write, right? And all the three pieces of information that we need to create a patch is available. An unsupervised write goes through that store instruction route, and the only thing we have is the address. We don't have the actual data that's written, size of the data, and that's because x86 doesn't provide all this information. So the question is, how do we extract that missing pieces of information so that we can create a patch? So that's what I'll focus on in the next slide, handling of unsupervised writes. If we had hardware that told you all of this information, then the operating system doesn't have to do anything. The problem is that architectures don't provide this information. Right. It can be very fast because the hardware provides you all of this. The operating system doesn't need to do any extra. But it's not practically feasible. The other approach is to single-step instructions. And what I mean by that is temporarily create a page. That's not the real page, just some page, and have the application write into it. So the data goes there, right? And then you extract the data from this temporary page, create the patch, and free the temporary page, right? That's what I mean by single-stepping instruction, right? And this is feasible with all architectures because all architectures have a single-stepping feature. It does require... There is some disassembly of the instruction required to actually. Yeah. Yes, so we disassemble the instruction in this specific solution a little bit, but not entirely. The next approach that we did implement is called page dip merge, where we allocate two pages, and this doesn't require what I told you just now. One zero page, one page. We write to both pages and take an XOR. And then we only need the length of the write. We know what was written by doing the XOR operation. So that's the next, but there are some issues with that. Also, it's not really fast with you because you have to do this XOR operation, which is compute intensive, and you need two pages. So these are some of the issues. The final solution that we did implement is to bite the bullet and do full disassembly. Really hard work, but that's what is required in this case because it provides good speed, works for all architectures, we can implement this assembly. And it turns out that, for instance, in Linux, for x86, the kernel itself has libraries for disassembly. Although it doesn't do exactly what we want, but a lot of the heavy lifting is already implemented inside the Linux kernel. So we use those libraries to implement. And there is no additional page requirement because we disassemble the instruction, find out what was written, look at the source, copy it into our patch, and get it. Now let me tell you about two optimizations that we did. The first is, what if the page fetch operation that we issued as soon as the fault occurred were done lazily instead? If you remember, I told you that the application doesn't really need the data contained in the page at all to make progress. So why issue the IO now? Maybe we can issue it when we actually need to.
This is a read point.
Right, exactly. So sure, that's what we did. Right, so a write comes in, page is not in memory. There is a miss, and there is step 6, which I'll talk about later. That's also a miss. Create the patches before. Return back to the application. No IO issue. Page is not necessary for the application. Keep going, right? The process at some later point, and this may never happen at all, performs a read operation on the page, but to a different offset, right? If it were the same offset, then we could keep serving it from the patch and keep going without fetching the page. But this is to a different offset. The application, or rather the OS, has no choice but to block the process, get the page in, right? So it issues the IO request. Wait for completion, page is populated in memory, first merges all the patches, right? And then allows the application to move forward. So here, the good thing is that allocating of the page memory and the fetching is avoided until absolutely necessary. Now the one thing that I didn't really stress here is that although we save on the I/O operation, we also save on memory, because we don't need DRAM to store the entire page. We just need to store the patch, which could be really small, right? So there are two savings. The memory savings is more subtle. The I/O savings is obvious because we avoid the I/O.
There is a durability issue.
There is a durability issue. So I'll talk about that also, because I have a section of the presentation where I talk about all the correctness issues, and the durability comes in there. The drawback here, though, which is also a drawback of the original design, as well as the blocking write design, and a drawback of our own non-blocking write design, is that resource utilization in terms of memory and I/O is unpredictable. So you need to do it when it is necessary. Right? You cannot do it in a planned fashion, and that can be a problem sometimes. So what happens if you know, all your pages are lazily fetched all at once, right? So you can incur a significant amount of blocking, and if it's an interactive application, that's bad for the user also, right? So you have to think about, you know, the predictability of the resource utilization. So although this optimizes certain aspects of the system, it still has problems. The same problems are shared with previous solutions. So how do we address it? So how do we address the predictability or making the resource utilization predictable, right? How could we do that?
Every time you have time or you have resource availability, you can...
Exactly, right? So use an oracle that is going to tell you when is the right time, and when is the right time depends on how much free memory you have, because you need memory to get the page in, and how much storage bandwidth you have. So use all that information to intelligently schedule the fetching of pages. So that's the scheduled page fetch, the second optimization. Process writes to... Well, we used an existing operating system. We modified Linux, but we did significant modification.
So lightweight.
Once we do all this, when you do this scheduled page fetch, the scheduling becomes, you know, adds some more intelligence, and it makes the solution more heavyweight. But hopefully it makes the solution more intelligent also. So again, when we schedule the page fetch, we have a miss, create a patch, return back to the application. Now at some later point, an oracle will trigger the page fetch. And this oracle, let's say it's running at some periodic time and monitors the amount of storage utilization, memory utilization, and says, well, now is a good time to fetch some of the pages. Triggers the OS, but this oracle is also inside the OS, just a subcomponent. It triggers the page fetch operation. OS issues the page fetch. It's completed, patch gets moved. Right?
So this is assuming that your memory is only bottleneck. You don't say I/O on the...
I/O on the storage could also be the bottleneck. So the oracle takes both into account, looks at the amount of memory, looks at the amount of storage bandwidth, and makes a decision. Right. So the drawbacks of the previous solution are avoided. Okay. So I'm going into the part of the presentation where I'll talk about a lot of correctness issues. Right. The first question is fetch or not to fetch. Right. Because I did say that there is this lazy page fetch optimization where we don't fetch the page until it's read. That's actually not really true. And I think Shiv Kumar brought up the point earlier that, you know, durability questions are important. You know, some pages do need to be written, especially files. When you write two files, you expect the file to be available on disk if power goes off. So periodic page flushing actually addresses that point. Inside current operating systems, what they do is that for instance in Linux, every 30 seconds, there is a flusher daemon which looks at all the pages that are dirty in memory, file system page cache pages, writes them out to disk. That's why you might have experienced that sometimes when you lose power, you also lose file data. And that's because that power got lost in the window between two periodic page flush operations. So this behavior needs to be preserved. So to preserve this behavior, what we do is that we observe that this periodic page flushing is an internal mechanism of the operating system. So when that internal mechanism gets triggered, we synchronously fetch the page, apply the patches, and so the semantic behavior of durability that the operating system provides to application system. Synchronous file writes is another such case. So if the application says, I want to make this write synchronous, what it means is that this write needs to be on disk, right, not in memory. If it's an asynchronous write, it just says on memory, and then the periodic page flusher will, you know, after some amount of time, make it durable. But synchronous writes need immediate durability, and again, we synchronously fetch the page when there is a synchronous page write. Patches get applied before the page gets written to storage. So all this happens synchronously, so we preserve the same behavior. The application gets blocked on a synchronous write until the page is fetched, updated, written back in.
Explicitly
asked. Yes. By default, applications do not get durability. They need to ask for it. The operating system provides durability on a periodic basis. The other thing is memory reclamation. The virtual memory system can free pages of memory. Right? If this is a page of memory that is not in physical memory, but has patches associated with it, and the operating system decides that this page needs to be free, we need to synchronously fetch the page, apply the update, and then write it out to storage. So again, we preserve the semantics that the operating system provides. So this is one set of issues, and there are more. And this addresses when to fetch and not.
So the old semantics in the second case.
Yes.
Standard semantic is that if I do a write, I expect that a synchronous fetch is going to happen in the write
block. Even though only to memory. Only to memory.
Page memory cat, and then the 30 second interval, whatever clock is going on.
Yes.
But as far as the application is concerned, it interface the word,
it's just memory.
But here you're saying my application interface is the word, it's just going to partly change because now I have to tell it I want a synchronous write.
Oh, no, you don't. It's the same as before, right? The application, if it was not doing synchronous writes, it doesn't need to do any synchronous writes because in that case, the operating system relies on the periodic page flushing to write the storage. And we preserve the semantics of the periodic page flushing.
So you're going to coincide your fetch and write or merge of the patches with the periodic page flushing?
Yes, correct. So the lazy is not always lazy because sometimes lazy triggers the page fetch upon a read. What's happening here is that the periodic page flusher is implicitly triggering that read operation.
So
right.
Now
you might have a piece of interpolation during that 30 second. The Oracle could trigger the page flush earlier than 30 seconds. At that time,
you
would be forced if the page is not in memory. Yes. So a few other corrections that there are some other OS-initiated page accesses. For instance, the flusher that I talked about. Also, there are journaling daemons that are running inside the OS that preserve the metadata correctness or even data consistency. And non-blocking writes is not used for any of those. It's only used for application issued writes, not OS internal writes. Right? So we preserve the same behavior. So internal mechanisms block. Applications don't need to block. Someone brought up the issue of synchronizing page operations. So if you have let's say you're overwriting the same page of memory, right? And that page is not in memory. Then our patch queue is handled in such a way that if you overwrite, the patch gets overwritten as well. So we provide the same, consistency properties as the conventional OS, where subsequent writes overwrite previous content. Right. Now they're doing it on the patch, and eventually the patch will get merged. Right. And read after write gets serialized correctly because if there is a blocking read, then the page gets fetched, first patches get applied, and then the read is allowed. If there is a read to a patch already contains the up-to-date data, So the read after write correctness also. Multiple page writes. If multiple processes or even the same process writes to multiple pages, if the process itself does not use any synchronizing mechanism, the operating system does not provide any ordering guarantees. Right? So those sort of ordering guarantees are not disturbed or not significantly ordered.
Yeah, there's a bashing here, lock model, right?
Yes.
You have lock overhead on every write.
On every write to an out of core page.
Yeah.
Yes. Handling of disk errors is something very interesting, right? That changes a little bit. But we argue that fundamentally it does not alter correctness. Because what would happen is that if there is a write to an out of core page in a conventional system and that portion of the disk becomes unreadable for some reason, the operating system will immediately panic. Right? It will basically crash. It will say, or it will keep retrying. And during the time of retry, the application cannot make any progress because of the blocking operation. In our case, what would happen is that disk error will be sort of masked for some amount of time because the application can still keep going and the operating system can keep trying in the background. So you can argue both ways. You can say it's a good thing, you can say it's a bad thing, but fundamentally it does not change correctness. It just changes or slightly alters the behavior of the system in non-fundamental ways. So again, you know, semantics of the OS remain unaltered. That's what we argue. So we did an evaluation.
There are no other non-deterministic ordering for the policy because of this.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm just here. So the reverse, we have to go through all possible ordering.
We remain unconvinced for a very long time, right? We thought about all kinds of possibilities for several weeks. And what could happen if this ordering occurred and if you have multiple processes and you have multiple pages, what happened if you have sharing of pages across processes? So we looked at all those possibilities and we boiled them down to these specifications that we thought were the most important, and we convinced ourselves at least to a large extent that we are not altering any correctness. The other reason why we feel confident that it doesn't alter behavior is because we actually did the implementation and we ran a variety of workloads and all the workloads eventually ran correctly. I mean, of course, we had bugs along the way, lots and lots of bugs. But eventually, when we fixed all the bugs, the workloads behaved the same as before and later, except that they ran much faster. But the results that we got, for instance, a whole bunch of computational file system intensive, and I'll talk about those workloads, they all ran. They all ran fine. They just ran faster. So in that way also we also convinced ourselves that, you know, this is something that does not fundamentally alter anything. Okay, so some specifics of our implementation. We implemented this for Linux. We implemented non-blocking writes for anonymous memory. These are the pages that can be directly written to by an instruction, right? And also for file system page cache pages, which are written to through the OS system call. Right? We ran a bunch of workloads, two classes, batch workloads, which are typically compute intensive and non-interactive, and then interactive class workloads. We ran spec CPU 2006 set of benchmarks that are compute intensive, and SFS and spec power are interactive workloads. Right. So for batch workloads, what you typically measure is completion time, so how quickly the application runs. For interactive workloads, what you typically measure is what is the latency of operation. So all of these interactive workloads will have operational latency information that they will output at the end of the execution. Say how many requests per second or how many seconds per request. So we measured those. The other thing that we did is that, you know, here the difficulty is in setting up the memory size, right? So how do you size memory for these workloads? So we set the memory size so that there is some IO activity that is exercised in this. The last bullet is not correct. That was for a previous system, so just ignore that. Savings in execution time. Okay. So what I'm showing on the y-axis is the percentage improvement, percentage rather reduction in the execution. So for most of the applications, you see that you know, there is savings in execution time, and then on an average, reduction is about 10%. The best case reduction is 48%. Worst case degradation is about 5%. And it turns out that for these two workloads, they are really compute intensive. They don't use memory much, which means if you don't use memory, there won't be any paging activity. And because we are, for whatever writes you do use external memory, you do incur some overhead with non-blocking. So that's the impact of the overhead. And also the other thing is that our implementation is very raw at this point. It's not finished and there are lots of loose ends. There are a lot of unoptimized portions of our implementation which all add overhead. For instance, searching through the patch queue, we started with a linked list and then we used a balanced binary tree. And things got better, but still it's not the best possible implementation, and we anticipate that these numbers will actually.
Do you have any way by which you can set up workloads where you can control the very fine granularity control, let's say, how often after write issue or read upper, things like that, you know, the control the window, can you actually set something
on granularity? So we wrote actually a bunch of micro benchmarks. For instance, I don't have the results here. I have it on a spreadsheet somewhere, and I can show you later. So what we did is that we created a micro benchmark that allocated a large amount of memory and did random writes. So every write will cause a page fetch, right? Then we did a benchmark where we wrote to a page sequentially, filled up the entire page, and then picked another random page, wrote it sequentially. And that creates a very different kind of behavior. That brings up some overheads, because if you write sequentially through an entire page, you're creating patches on each write. Page fetch is happening in the background, but the thing is that there is additional overhead inside the system, first to maintain the patches, and also additional faults that occur. So that's sort of the hidden overhead of our system. So if you write to an entire page sequentially, it turns out that in some cases, if the hardware is fast enough and storage is not a bottleneck, it's better to block, fetch the page, and then write the entire page, rather than keep writing while the IO is happening, because there are some overheads associated with the write operation as well. So your writing is slowing down when you're creating
patches. But the read after write scenario, I
think
you had some diagram
early on.
Right. Basically, there can never be a situation worse than
the
agency.
So
I'm wondering where the
5%
degradation
comes from. Right. I think this is really complex. So it's very hard to profile it and find out exactly where the time is being spent. But we are doing a lot of that. In my opinion, what's happening is that we have an implementation that's not perfect. Or rather, we have an unoptimized implementation where we are spending CPU time on things that we shouldn't be spending time on. So there we are losing time. The other thing which I can speculate is that there is a lot of variance in these numbers. Every time we run, first of all, we use a very basic OS. We don't use any graphical user interface or anything of that sort, because that introduces noise in the system. So we use a minimal OS instance. And I mean, for those who are familiar with Linux, we use, you know, run level 3, right? So run level 3 has no GUI, it has a very basic kernel, and we run our benchmark. And even with that, we have variance when we do our measurements. So we did 10 measurements, there is about 20% variance. Right. So that there is some variance that also plays in here. Right. These are averaged across several executions, and I'm reporting average numbers, but there is variance. So there is again that issue there.
So the write always followed by a read.
There is no real benefit in that case. Yeah, we have to pay.
Because in any case, if you had issued the read and you block after the write was completed, then that amount of time you would have waited for the write to complete, maybe again memory attack. You had those little pictures that showed the parallelization and the
yes.
There's no worst case scenario than what's going to be
I mean, in the worst case, we should be equal in performance.
Yeah,
But there is the medicinal work we are doing.
No, but we are creating
iodine.
Correct.
We
marked
by iodine.
Nothing compared to what the
doctor
said.
But
just
the
research
is supposed to go back down. So that's the need.
It's still being marked by iodine. Otherwise, the need for block for the iodine to come in from there.
True.
The iodine is like this thing and the forehead is like.
What is the reason? We are still doing, So, here are the savings in response time for interactive workloads. So, I said there are two workloads. SFS is actually file system workload. So, network file system workload, client and server. So, we implemented non-blocking rights on the server side. The client side we left untouched. And but I'll come to that in a bit. What happens when you do non-blocking rights on the client side? Very interesting as well. And spec power. So you see here that there are multiple variants of spec SFS. There is a basic spec SFS, and then there is write intensive and read intensive. The read intensive doesn't mean that there are only reads; there are also writes. And you can see the savings are the greatest when you have a write intensive. In relative terms. Spec power, there was not really significant difference. We don't really know what this workload does, but maybe in the this represents some sort of a close to worst case where we don't really do all that bad. Right? We do equal.
So even in
your
write intensive, and if you randomize write across pages, then you get better benefits for
you. Yes.
Especially write
some pages. Right, absolutely. So this was all with the basic approach. No lazy, none of the optimizations were engaged. Yeah, we haven't implemented the optimizations. I just told you about it. Well, the other thing is that the deviation in cost turns out to be reduced. Now let me tell you a little bit about other use cases for non-blocking rights. The first is hypervisor demand paging. What hypervisor demand paging does is that it allows virtual machine to overcommit memory. That a virtual machine may request for 4 gigabytes of DRAM, and the hypervisor may give it only 2 gigabytes. And then it implements another level of demand paging at the hypervisor level. Right? Now, the interesting thing is that when the hypervisor takes a fault, that blocks an entire vCPU, a virtual CPU. It's not a process. Multiple processes, all are occupying their entire vCPU, right? So it's an even more significant issue than a process taking a fault. It's a vCPU taking a fault. And non-blocking rights unblocks vCPU. Yes.
So
GDM
has
asynchronous
page faults for
For reads as well as writes?
There are page faults.
Okay. But how can you... So it's scheduled. So the vCPU somehow gets scheduled. So I think KVM has that in probably that optimization that I was not familiar with. ESX doesn't have that optimization. So in some cases it does. That has to reduce vCPU. NFS clients, very interesting, right? So when you write. When you're on the client side, you write to a file that's sitting on a server somewhere over the network. If that page that was written into is not in memory, you will fetch the page over the network first, update the page, and allow the application to progress. With non-blocking writes, that entire network plus disk latency happens in the background. Right? So NFS clients can benefit quite a bit. Now, the other application we found out, someone suggested this to us, is with post-copy live VM migration. So I'm sure you know about live VM migration, where a virtual machine is moved from one physical host to another physical host, all the while it's running, doing things, live VM migration. So when you have live VM migration, the way post-copy live VM migration works is that you immediately start the VM on the destination rather than wait for all the memory pages to migrate first. Right? There's pre-copy, which is more conventional, where you first migrate the pages and then switch the VM over. Post-copy is something that's new and it's used by default in, you know, ESX DRS, VMware DRS. And in that case, the reason you're migrating the VM in the first place is to offload work. And this allows you to offload work immediately, right? Because you start your VM on the destination. But the problem is that the memory is not yet moved. And it turns out that a lot of dirty pages that are getting written into were already dirty in the source. So your writes always need fetching over the network. With non-blocking writes, you can eliminate that fetch over the network by storing the updates. So in summary, this approach is a new approach that revisits a 40-year-old problem, right? Of blocking processes when processes write to out-of-core pages. Right? And the advantage of solving this problem is that we have reduced execution time, increased device utilization. In our results, these are all preliminary results, by the way. I'm hoping that we'll have results that we can be more confident about in the near future, but the preliminary results are also very encouraging. The ongoing and future work involves evaluating alternate implementations that we are currently doing, lazy and scheduled page set optimization. The one thing that we are looking at, for instance, is persistent patches. So earlier, we talked about the durability question. When you write to a file system page, you expect that data to be on in the file. But if you think about it a little bit more deeply, right, you have the update in your patch. You could just make that patch persistent and keep going, and you still have durability. As long as the file system can resolve that patch when the read happens in the future. So that's something we are looking into right now. Cannot be applied for anonymous pages, and for anonymous pages, you actually only need lazy. Right, but when you crash, you don't expect your process to come back up anyway.
So that case,
this persistent patch is not useful, not necessary. You don't need to fetch pages. You can completely do with just a lazy approach, where a patch is pages fetched on the read. So let me acknowledge the people in the lab. And not all of them worked on this project. Actually, the people who worked are Jesus, Lewis, and to some extent Ricardo. And the others are just people in the lab. They do other projects. So thank you very much for listening to me. This concludes what I had planned. Now, I don't know if we have time. I can tell you a bit about that other work if there is time, or I can do it offline. Okay.
I guess you can do that if you want.
Yes, if people want to leave. Right. We haven't measured that. That's something we have to do. I mean, this is, at this point, it's, in my view, it's preliminary, but we do have results that tell us that it's worth pursuing. And for those who are interested in knowing a bit more about the non-blocking rights work, we had a paper in last year's Hot Storage. It's a 5-page position paper that tells you a bit about this. And if you're more interested, I can share this presentation with you. Okay, so now let me tell you about this other piece of work that you might find more related to what you're doing. It's about partitioning SSD caches. So to tell you a little bit about the problem setting, hypervisors today, they are increasingly starting to manage host side SSD caches, which are caching a portion of virtual disks that are located somewhere over the network in network storage. And servers today are coming with host side flashes. A lot of them are coming with host side flashes as the default, defaultly configurable option. So you can buy a blade server which has some SSD cache in it and use it, right? As long as the hypervisor knows how to use it. So that's the problem setting we are looking at. And the problem itself can be summarized in this chart. If you have two VMs, right, running that are sharing that single host side SSD cache, and they are now managed using a global LRU page replacement, then it turns out that when the VMs run individually, that's the graph on top, you have this virgin set behavior that is depicted using miss rate curve. Right? So as you increase the size of the cache, how many misses occur in the cache, right? So you would expect that as you increase the size of the cache, the number of misses is going to go reduce, right? Assuming that the cache management algorithm is intelligent, right? And typically you have LRU class cache management algorithms which work pretty well. Now these are second level caches, so you would use something like ARC, right? Or L2ARC, let's say. And again, you would see the same behavior. So you see sort of this knee breaking. And that's the point at which your misses drop substantially, which means your basic working set is now fitting inside the cache. So you have a lot fewer misses. So when you run the workloads independently or individually, there is no interference. And those are how the working sets look like. And where the knee breaking is the first working set size is of A, the second working set size is of B. When you run them together, what you would expect is that the knee would break on A plus B, right? In the best case, but it turns out that that's not true, because there is this weird behavior that we observed a while back, that the combined working set size is actually larger than the sum. It's a very curious behavior, right? So the sum is 246, but the combined working set is 269. You might think it's not much, but I'll tell you in a bit, it's really bad. And I'll tell you why. Right? In this case itself, you can see that if you look at it from a percentage standpoint, right, 269 is 10% more than 246. Right? That's bad. You're wasting 10% of your cache resource because of this weird behavior that we don't yet understand. Right? So unified caches have this tendency to induce wastage. And that's because these workloads interfere with each other. The pages that they access interfere with what is necessary for the other workloads. So although we see or observe this problem, to understand the problem itself, you know, conceptually, what we need to know is that this cache is managed as a global LRU. Pages that are important in one workload might transitorily be evicted because temporarily some of the pages of the other workload became important, right? So it's a problem of long-term sustained importance versus short-term intermittent importance. And when that happens, there is this interference and that causes waste. Right? Conceptually, that's how at least I understand this problem. We did this some prior work with for CPU caches. There is wastage in CPU caching. So we did some work in that space with Akshat for CPU caching. The same behavior occurs there also. And CPU caches, the problem is worse, because the solution that I'm going to tell you now for SSD caches cannot be applied to CPU caches. Okay. So here is another more scary chart, which is that the wastage as you add more and more workloads, the wastage increases linearly as a percentage of the cache size, or the percentage of the total sum of working cells. It's not a constant. So earlier we thought that, okay, this wastage is something small and it should be a constant, so let's say we can over-provision by 10% and we'll deal with the wastage. Turns out not to be the case. As you increase the tenancy, and today you have hundreds of VMs running on a single host, if they share an SSD cache, you have a significant issue. If you look at the second chart, as a percentage, as you increase the number of workloads, the wastage increases. If you go up to 100, you have more than 100% wastage. It means you need twice as much cache if you are managing it using a unified LRU-based replacement. So this is a real problem that we need to solve. And that's what I was telling you earlier. So how do you solve this problem? What is the solution? Very good. So the solution is exactly that. Solution is to partition the cache and apply individual replacement on each of those partitions. So you bypass the interference. So one workload cannot interfere with the cache space of the other workload. Okay. Now, at a high level, that's the right solution, but it turns out that it's not an easy solution to implement because there are multiple problems that you need to now address. The first being, most basic, is how to size the individual cache partition. Okay, so you have a unified cache, the replacement algorithm already automatically does the sizing for you based on importance. But now if you had a partitioned cache, how do you size those individual caches? Not easy, right? Puru told me that some of you guys were working on similar questions and that's why I decided to talk about this. Yeah. So you are doing something with memory.
Yeah, so I'm teaching solving for host and page cache.
Right.
Say that you have some here, you use the host page cache over it. So on the file you move to that.
Right.
And instead of having one giant LRU list, partition that per mile basically. So
right.
In each year this is keeping the file, this works out quite nicely.
Right.
The whole problem is how do you size that, how do you motion that? What's the total amount of cache for the
end? Right. The thing about the global LRU is that it takes care of a lot of problems for you, right? Because as the workload changes, it automatically adapts. It tells you, okay, now this workload doesn't need so much cache because its important set of pages is much smaller. And there is an automatic sizing behavior. If you want to do a sizing, it's not a static sizing, right? You want to do it dynamically. As the workload changes, you have to change the size. So how do you go about doing that? That's the real challenge.
Partitions reduce the use of actual pages that are shared among multiple workloads. Does that affect caching?
I think it would.
But even if the caching level, that's problem.
So
caching is like this, reducing the memory to run the sharing and
But no, I think how do you account for this? So the sharing will be implemented.
The same page will present in two partitions.
I think, Umesh, what you're talking about, if I understand correctly, is that how do you do the accounting of the shared page, right? Whom do you attribute that? We're not precluding it, but rather we are introducing a new problem, which is how to account for shared pages. Now, where do we attribute it? Do I say that this page is used by VM1 or VM2 or both? Right? Because there is only one instance of the page. But I think that requires some additional consideration. But it can be done. So we actually implemented a system inside ESX hypervisor. And by the way, the problem that we had to deal with doesn't occur in your case. I'm going to tell you about a problem that we had to solve, which you don't have to solve, which probably makes your life easier. But it's, you know, it's still a hard problem that you need to address. So inside the ESX hypervisor, we implemented two things. One is a data mover that opportunistically and let's say eagerly gets data from the network storage into the local SSD cache, does it periodically. And the global scheduler figures out how to partition the cache across all the VMs. And all of this happens as necessary and triggered periodically. If the repartitioning is necessary, it occurs. Data movement is necessary, it occurs, otherwise it doesn't. Now, I'll tell you the problem that we had to solve that you don't really have to solve because of the way caches are accessed. So the first thing is that when you start combining these miss rate curves, right, you take the individual miss rate curves and just take a sum of those miss rate curves. So here you see the red and blue line, red solid and blue dotted line. Those are individual miss rate curves. What I've done is I've just flipped the red MRC so that it's easier to visualize the sum of the MRC. Now if you want to take a partition, how do you create the partition? The best partition is to take the minimum point of the sum of the MRC. You can see that the minimum curve is not monotonic. So it's not easy to find the minimum. So what conventionally the CPU cache partitioning work has done is that it takes a convex hull of the sum function and makes it smooth. And then you walk down the convex hull, you're always guaranteed to find the minimum, right? So that's what people have done in the past. It turns out that it will work for you, but it won't work for the problem that we are solving, right? And I'll tell you why. When we manage an SSD cache, we manage the SSD cache at some basic granularity, let's say a page. But the IOs that are coming to the SSD cache can be arbitrary sized. So when you have an IO that is larger than a page, you have some portion, let's say, cached, the rest of it is not cached. It's actually not a partial hit, it's a miss. Because what you have to do is to get data over the network, and that dominates the cost of handling the miss. Right? And that introduces a new problem in the SSD cache. In the memory cache, maybe this problem exists. I need to think more, but we can talk about this later. But let me tell you what the problem we had to deal with is. Right? So if you have an MRC, the first MRC is when the workload accesses a file, let's say a virtual disk, uniformly. No, random, but at a page, single page granularity, it's accessing only one page, randomly, right? So as you increase the size of the cache, the miss rate will linearly decrease because more and more of the working set will start fitting inside the cache, right? At some point, the entire working set will fit and your miss rate drops to zero. At that point, or close to zero, because at that point, you do have some compulsory miss, right? So that's the first MRC. The second MRC is the first one I've shown you in solid line, but there is another MRC which is dotted, and that happens when instead of accessing the virtual disk at 64, or rather a page granularity, the virtual machine is accessing it at 64 page granularity. The cache is still managed at a page granularity. The MRC turns out to be concave in this case. So, because as you increase the size of the cache, only portions of that 64-page request would be cached. Because if this cache is now managed at a different granularity than what is accessed by the VM. So, the MRC also changes substantially because of that behavior. Right? And VMs, we cannot force VMs to access the cache at a certain granularity. So, we have to solve this problem. And the problem is that both of these curves have the same convex minority. Right? So if you were to take a sum of such convex minorities, and let's say that the partition is at 500,000 cache blocks, our estimate of miss rate for this specific workload is off by 60%. So the convex minor end can be really bad approximation, right? In this specific scenario. The convex minor end works well if the MRCs are relatively convex. But if the MRCs become concave like this, the convex minor end really is a bad approximation, right? So that's what we had to deal with. I think, I mean, now that I think a little bit more, you might have to deal with the same problem in your work as well. So then, I mean, once the problem is obvious, then the solution becomes rather simple as well, right, or obvious. Is that you have to use full MRCs. You're not left with a choice, right? You want to use the correct information. But then you cannot do the full search anymore. You have to do this probabilistically so that you can respond quickly to changes. So that's what we do. We use simulated annealing to search for the minima. We might sometimes see local minima instead of global minima, but that's better than having an arbitrary error using the convex minor end approach. Okay. So we built a solution. Some of the properties of the solution is that we do online MRC construction. So that's another thing that's changing. Your MRCs are changing because your workload is changing. And we do full MRC-based dynamic partitioning. In our solution, we ran this algorithm to compute MRCs to do the partitioning every 5 minutes. That turned out to be okay for the workloads we were using. Online partition resizing. And the other thing to be careful about is that when there is oversubscription, you need to be able to degrade gracefully. Right? So when the working sets don't fit in your cache, then how do you manage your cache? Right? You need to be able to do that. We did a couple of studies. The first is a boot storm, where you have a whole bunch of VMs simultaneously booting. What we did is we trained with an initial boot sequence and figured out what the cache partitions were. We used those partitions to partition the cache, ran two solutions, one with a globally managed cache and the other one with partition. The boxes are the partitions, and each point is an actual boot time for a specific VM. There are 28 VMs, right? So 20% reduction in average boot time. So that's what we get by partitioning. The other more important finding is that our variance reduces. Because with a globally managed cache, you have a lot of interface, uncontrolled interface. So some VMs really suffer. Other VMs really benefit. When you have partitioning, you have more fairness. So that's the other thing we saw. We also looked at some production storage traces from FIU, right? And these are obtained from our data center, virtual machine traces. So 8 servers, all accessing network storage. So we replayed block level IO traces. And then what we counted in this case was the number of misses in a shared SSD caching medium. As you increase the size of the cache, partition cache is able to deliver much better miss rate because of lower interference in the global cache.
So, what is the meaning
that high cache sizes? Well, at high cache sizes, all the working sets fit in the cache. So, there is no interference. Everything fits in cache. You buy more cache. That's one possibility, yes. So the conclusions here are that partitioning is really crucial for both throughput and fairness. And in this case, ours is a conventional convex hull-based approach to do the partitioning itself, not work. We have to do approximations and probabilistic search. Some new work that we are doing is to really understand the nature of this waste case, why it occurs. What is the extent of it? We saw this behavior, which seems very alarming, right? But fundamentally, can we quantify the extent of the waste? Right? Those are some of the questions. And also, we're looking at QoS control. So IO latency reduces as you increase cache size because a lot of the IOs are served locally. So can you use this sort of cache dynamic sizing as a form of QoS control for latency? Not yet published. It got turned down at ATC, so we are revising it. Yeah.
Okay.
Any questions? By the way, I like all your questions. I mean, you guys are very interactive. Very. That's a good sign. Very good sign, actually.
Okay, so
let's
start.
Thank
you. So, maybe for the next hour or so, what we do is, guys are interested in talking to us more.